This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe, Andre Loy. He's author of the book, The Myths of Safe Pesticides. He's the president of iFoam Organics International. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have been talking here at the Kivira Conference about an idea called Organic 3.0, the third paradigm shift. What were 1.0 and 2.0? What is this paradigm shift that we're at now?
1.0 is our pioneers. And we've had many pioneers. Some of the most significant ones are people like Sir Albert Howard, who's the father of modern composting, and wrote a book called The Agricultural Testament. And that book had a big influence on J.O. Rodale, who was a publisher in New York. And he put out a book called Organic Farming and Gardening that was taken up all around the English-speaking world, and that's why we use the word organic farming. 2.0 is when we start to codify the practices and teachings of our pioneers, our founders, and we put them into standards. And farmers, we actually drove it. I'm part of that 2.0 generation, although to a degree I'm still a 1.0 as well because I pioneered systems. But this started in the 1970s when I started farming organically. We took that information and we started to make our first standards, which were basically one page. Then these eventually got taken up by regulators and became hundreds and thousands of pages, much to our distress. But the fact is, by having these credible certification systems is very important to drive our industry. It's worth $72 billion US a year, and it's the fastest growing of all food segments, simply because consumers can trust certified organic. So, for instance, the year that the USDA seal, the NOP seal came out, there was a 45% increase in the sales of organic products because now consumers could see one logo that they could trust. And this is very important for growth. So that's Organic 2.0, which is the regulatory standards framework. Organic 3.0 is a much bigger vision. We want to look at complete holistic systems. We want to engage with the mainstream. We don't want to be a niche. We don't want to be 1%. We want to show that we can be an active part of the many solutions needed for our many problems in the world. For instance, climate change is a very good example of how we can actively contribute to reversing global warming and improving food production. The other thing with Organic 3.0, what we want this to be is a bottom-up approach, not a top-down. We're spending 2 years to consult with our stakeholders, not just our members, our stakeholders all around the world.
What do you mean by stakeholders?
Well, I'd regard the people here today. They're on the same wavelength. Okay, they mightn't call themselves organic, but we see them as like-minded organizations.
Basically, people involved in rethinking agriculture.
Exactly, exactly. We don't want to just limit it to just our little silo. We want to reach out and be part of other groups, and also not be stuck on a name. I think this is a big problem here as well, because we want to look at what other people are doing. We can learn a lot from other people. People can learn from us. And I think this is really important to be, not saying our system is better than yours, but we're all like-minded people on a similar path. Let's all work together and be friends, share, see how we can all do it better. So that's a really important part of Organic 3.0 for us.
I thought you were going to say that the stakeholders is everybody, because human health is the bottom line on all of this.
Exactly, and the stakeholders are everybody, because the most important stakeholder are the consumers. Without them, we don't have people buying it. We don't have the $72 billion industry. It's actually larger than that. Just to certify it is 72. That's our consumers. So they are a significant stakeholder for us as well.
So now, I mean, we're at this place where organic food, organic agriculture is still a very small amount of the whole, but more people are beginning to understand it. I mean, where are we at in the world?
We're still globally around 1%. In some countries, we're actually up to 15% or more, close to 20%, or some of the very small ones like the Falkland Islands, we're, you know, 45%. Country like Bhutan intends to go 100% organic. But the reality is we can say 1% globally.
There are a lot of myths about organic farming, and I've talked to some people, well-educated, highly intelligent people, who say, well, you know, the yields are much lower and therefore it's just not powerful enough to feed the world. What is your work? You've been at this most of your life. What are your studies showing?
Firstly, what I want to say is that average yields in organic at the moment are 80% of conventional. And this is because we haven't had the science and the research and the trillions of dollars spent on us that have been spent on conventional agriculture. What I would put there is that if those trillions of dollars have just made a 20% increase in yield over what farmers, what we've worked out by ourselves, you know, that's all they've achieved since, you know, the end of World War II, 70 years ago, that's a very poor outcome. Now we are getting science, and what I presented today are some of the peer-reviewed scientific studies showing that organic systems, properly managed, properly worked out, can get equal to higher yields than conventional systems.
So organic agriculture right now overall is lower in yield than so-called conventional agriculture. It's funny that it's called conventional because it's, I mean, in the history of farming, which is millennia old, we're talking about something that's 60 years old and now it's conventional. But that aside, there are some organic agricultural installations, farms, that are actually producing very high yields, and particularly in drought years. What's going on?
Look, this is one of the really important issues that we have now in the science. We have good science showing that organic systems can get up to 30% higher yields in drought years. And this is because by increasing organic matter, we increase the infiltration and capture and storage of water. So when we go into drought, we have a better reservoir of water, which keeps the yields up. And it's consistent. Can I say I have a lot of studies now showing, on average, organic systems are higher yielding than conventional in drought years. And this is really important now that we, as we go into climate change, we're finding what were 1 in 30 year events are now 1 in 5, and we expect that frequency to increase.
1 in 30 year events of what sort?
Of extreme weather. Hurricanes, droughts, floods, tornadoes, you name it. What we're seeing were 1 in 30 year events. We're seeing happen 1 in every 5 years. And it's predicted that this frequency will increase. So every 4 years, every 3 years, as we go further into climate change.
And so what does that mean when you talk about an organic farm? I mean, are organic farms more resistant to these events, or what are you saying?
They are more resilient, and particularly the smaller, diverse polyculture systems that have multiple crops. After Hurricane Mitch, for instance, when it hit Central America, it's the organic agroecological systems that had good polycultures were the ones that survived the best. This is a Category 5 hurricane, wiped out a lot of farming, but these systems, because they had multiple crops, didn't lose all of them. And very importantly, they recovered so much faster than the other systems. So we have now good data on how to cope with the increase in hurricanes and violent storms. And as I said before, we have very good data to show how we can continue to have good yields in drought conditions.
I think it's also really important to talk about the fact that when you talk about organic farming, and a lot of people now are using the word regenerative farming, restorative agriculture, concepts like that, it's not just about having a crop and taking away pesticides and chemical fertilizers. It's about different ways of thinking about farming. For example, planting, like you said, different crops in the same field that have synergistic effects with one another.
Yeah. Look, exactly right. And emerging science now is showing these synergies of plants. You know, we need to get rid of this concept that any other plant that is not our crop is a weed, and get rid of that, because that's a very outdated concept. In fact, we have a new emerging science, what we call selective allelopathy. Allelopathy is where one plant suppresses another one. But with selective allelopathy, we can put in plants. An example I'll give is something like desmodium in corn. And what the desmodium will do is suppress the weeds that affect the corn.
So desmodium is a plant?
It's a legume. It's another plant that grows below the corn, so it doesn't compete for light. It is a legume, so it provides all the nitrogen. So we don't need any nitrogen fertilizer. It fixes it for free from the air. And it repels the weeds. It puts a ground cover over the soil, so there's no bare soil, so we don't lose it to water or wind erosion. And the other thing it does, it repels the corn borer moth and repels it out of the corn, so it stops pest attacks. So the word we use for this now is functional biodiversity, where we can bring in other plants that have multiple beneficial functions to help our crop. As this science improves, and part of it actually has been, in most cases, actually been worked out by farmers, but now science, we're getting science behind it to improve it, we are finding that these systems have the lowest input costs. We don't need all the fertilizers and pesticides. And we're finding, too, that they're highly productive. In Africa, for instance, where these systems are introduced, such as one is called push-pull, where they put the desmodium in the corn, they're getting more than 100% increases in yield, phenomenal increases, taking people out of abject poverty. They used to go for several months of the year without eating, into prosperity. They're building nice houses. They can send their children, particularly their daughters, to school. They can buy new clothes and socialize. They can afford health care, which they couldn't afford before. It just changes their life and revitalizes the whole community.
There's something it seems like it's so liberating when you're using plants to capture water, to hold the soil in place, to repel pest types of insects and things like that, instead of using things that you have to buy from the outside.
Look, exactly. And this is a really important thing now. We're going from, you know, when we're looking at the cost structure of farming now, our returns are very, very small. And as farmers, we need to reduce all our input costs. So what we can essentially do on farm and use solar energy to do for free and power it rather than buying it improves our bottom line, because that is money that we're not spending outside. We can spend on ourselves and our family. It's very logical. But these systems now are becoming a true win-win, that we can dramatically lower the production costs, we can increase yields. And the other thing that we're doing too with these systems, by certifying them, is increasing the amount that they get sold for. So we're not only getting the farmer more yield, we're giving them a higher return for their product.
Because the product is more valuable?
Yeah, it's seen as more valuable. It's a really important thing. We can differentiate it on the market. That's what organic certification has done. I know we get some critics, but in the end, it's very important for the consumer. If they're going to pay a premium, they want to be sure that what they buy is what they get. It's not fraudulent. So we need to have a guarantee system of the integrity of the production system. By doing that, consumers are prepared to pay more, and we can return that back to the farmer.
We are talking to author and organic farming expert Andre Loy. It's interesting, too, because I mean, one of the reasons that organic food is more expensive is because it goes through this certification process. But there's another thing that isn't counted, which is that so-called conventional food has a lot of pesticides on it and herbicides on it and things that aren't good for you, basically, that cause diseases and all kinds of health problems. And the cost of those health problems isn't factored into the cost of the food.
Exactly. Look, this is why, as part of Organic 3.0, we want to have true value or true pricing. What the true value of a product is, and in organic food, we believe that that is true value that people are paying for, whereas the conventional food comes with a whole lot of other costs that aren't paid for. What they will be paid for eventually, they'll either be paid for by, as we're seeing, by the increase of chronic diseases and health costs for people, particularly for children. They're also paid for in environmental costs. And in many cases, you know, they will be paid for by future generations who will have to restore the damage, who aren't here to defend themselves against this. We're stealing from our future generations.
How could you, is there a way to build that cost into the price of food?
There are, and there are some good examples of it, but as part of Organic 3.0, we want to look at this and how we can do it more consistently, how we can get these messages across the consumers so they actually realise that they're actually getting good value for money. This is why I use the word true value, because sometimes the cheapest is not the best value. And, you know, for the discerning consumer, it's not always about price. It's also about quality. You know, so we want to get these messages across that it's not expensive, it is actually very good value for what you're paying.
What is the role of organic farming, regenerative farming, in mitigating and perhaps even reversing climate change?
This is, I think, one of the biggest strengths that we've got. We've done the research. We know that organic farms will increase soil organic matter faster than other farms. At best, most conventional farms can either keep organic matter levels the same or just slow down the rate of loss of organic matter, whereas we increase it. And the work we've done where we've extrapolated this increase as against how much carbon we need to take out of the atmosphere shows that with our systems, if we scaled up organic globally, we could actually reverse it. And the reason I want to use the word reversing is because it is not good enough just to stop the pollution at this stage, because the greenhouse gases we put out will actually continue to affect us and increase climate change over the next 50 to 100 years or longer before they dissipate. And, you know, if next month in Paris they get an agreement to basically limit the amount of greenhouse gases that we're putting out, that will not stop climate change. And all the experts, as of the last few weeks, are saying we're on a trajectory. The best case scenario is 3.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, but 4 degrees is regarded as catastrophic climate change. And many of them are saying we're on a trajectory to 5 degrees. It's very scary. So we need to actively take this carbon dioxide out of the air, and we can do that through photosynthesis. Plants absorb it, but very importantly, we can store it in the ground, which is the largest repository for carbon. And in doing so, by building up the soil organic matter, because that's what it's made of, we increase the resilience of the farming systems. Because even if, like I say, tomorrow we get an agreement, we're still going to go further into climate change. And even if we start reversing it, it's going to take decades before we change it and go back to pre-industrial temperatures. So we have to have resilient farming systems. So this is the win-win. We can not only reverse climate change, but we can make our systems resilient against the extreme weather events that are coming with it.
Say more about that, because, I mean, I understand that when plants photosynthesize, they take carbon dioxide and water, they convert those things into essentially sugars, right?
Glucose.
Glucose that then goes down into the roots of the plant that builds the plant, that makes the plant grow. Then we eat that plant or part of that plant, and that goes through us and it becomes carbon dioxide again. Where is the permanent storage piece of that?
What we know, when a plant grows, basically, you know, when we look at a plant, we say that what we see above the ground, which is the leaves and trunk, is about equal to what is below the ground, the roots. But there's another third again, which is the roots excrete this carbon, these sugars, amino acids, these other carbon-based compounds, into the soil to feed the microbes, the soil biota, it's called the rhizosphere. It's actually the area on the earth with the highest biodiversity and surround the roots of plants. These microbes do a whole range of things like make minerals available for plants. They stop diseases. They prevent the diseases from invading the plants. There's a whole range of really important things they do to build healthy soils. You can say this is synergism. They get fed these sugars and these other compounds by the plants, and they help the plants take up minerals. So it's a wonderful exchange. So when we grow plants, we're actually depositing 30%. So if you look at a tree and imagine what you see in front of you, we've got that again in the soil as roots, but that much again has gone into the soil as carbon. And if we've got deep roots, we'll go deep into the soil, and much of that carbon will stay there. Similarly, as plants die, and they do at some stage in decay, or roots decay, part of the carbon in plants is in the form of what are called lignans. And lignans are needed to keep plants flexible so they don't snap. They can wave in the breeze. And it's those lignans that the microorganisms turn into humus. And humus is stable carbon. It lasts for over 2,000 years in the soil. It holds 30 times its own weight in water. This is why we can drought-proof, by building up this humus. It holds most of the nitrogen, which gives free nitrogen to plants, and multiple benefits. It gives the soil stability. It's like a glue. It stops it from eroding. So it's these stable forms of carbon that come from our plants, but it gets down to how we manage them, and this is the critical thing. Everybody grows plants, but not everybody can increase soil organic matter. It's the actual management system that will make the difference.
Now, that management system is something that you have been studying for a long time, that you've been practicing for a long time, and it's something that you are teaching, that is being taught. How are these sets of ideas being spread?
We, at the moment, are teaching it, particularly in lectures at universities. I do a lot of lectures in universities. There's a group of us doing it, showing how it can be done, but it needs to be scaled up globally. We have literature out on it, but one of the things I intend to do is, in the next year, put a book out on it so we can actually show examples of best practice. And these are ones that can get very quick increases in soil organic matter. These are the management systems that we need to scale up globally to both reverse climate change and increase the resilience of all of agriculture. And when I'm talking agriculture, I'm talking grazing, cropping, permanent systems like orchards, the whole of agriculture.
I mean, these are very interesting numbers. You have a tree or you have a plant. A third of the carbon that it takes out of the air goes into the plant that you see. A third of it goes into the root system, and another third goes into the soil. The soil gets deeper. The soil gets healthier. It has all these microorganisms that have only recently even been really identified and studied. I think of them kind of as like the working class. You know, you don't necessarily see what they do or appreciate it, but like the people who build the roads, you never see them. But you travel on those roads every day, and it makes the plant possible. Now, it's a beautiful thing, and it's the way nature evolved over hundreds of millions of years. What happens to that system, that three-part system, the plant, the root system, and this microorganism community when you spray pesticides?
Exactly. That's a really important issue. You know, these are toxins. They're designed to kill. And so when we look at both pesticides and also synthetic fertilizers, we find a collapse in these microbial communities and very low biodiversity. And in many cases, the ones that survive in the microbial communities are the diseases, the pathogens. We find higher levels of those, but we've lost the other microorganisms that are the predators that control them. And so you see all these plant diseases now come out, and then they have to put more poisons in to sterilize the soil. So you get to a point like strawberry production where they fumigate it, and it's dead. There's nothing there in terms of any living microbes.
So the effects of that are multiple. I mean, soil quality decreases and carbon absorption decreases. That's just two.
Exactly. And for me, one of the most important studies comes out of the University of Illinois, the Morrow plots. They're the second oldest, longest continuous agricultural experiments. And they have examples of farming systems that go back to the 1880s where they never used any of the pesticides or chemical fertilizers. Conventional agriculture as it appeared after World War II. And there you can see an incredible difference, particularly, say, for instance, the use of nitrogen fertilizers, because what that does, it changes the microbial communities to ones, instead of building organic matter out of the lignans and building these stable long chains of humus, they actually consume all the carbon, because in the soil you have what's called a carbon to nitrogen ratio, and microbes have what's called a carbon to nitrogen ratio, particularly bacteria, and that's between 15 to 1, usually up 25 to 30 to 1. So as you stimulate these microbes, for every pound of nitrogen you put in, you can be chewing up to 25 pounds of carbon and turning it into carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And what they found was around 36,000 pounds of carbon was being chewed up, soil carbon, per acre, per year, because of using these synthetic nitrogen fertilizers and stimulating the wrong kind of microbes.
You talked earlier about regenerative agriculture being a win-win. It seems like a win-win-win-win. There's a lot of winning things, because you're talking about illnesses like cancer and other illnesses that are, I think you can talk about this, but pretty good evidence, caused by pesticides and herbicides and things like that. There's climate change mitigation. You can absorb so much carbon into soil. There's healthier food. There's also more prosperity and kind of independence for the farmers. Is there a downside?
I don't think there is a downside. It's, the hard thing for us is to actually get this message out, but we actually believe there's been a huge paradigm shift. You know, for those of us that have been involved in this, in my case, over 40 years, and have gone from being regarded as idiots, nutcases, to we're being seen as credible. Governments are coming to us now and asking for our advice. That it's changed, and we're seeing this paradigm shift now. Big business now. You know, last year, the food companies in the US lost over $4 billion because consumers are changing what they want. And they're being forced now to change and adopt organic and regenerative production systems, you know, for the food that they sell. So we're seeing this change happening and this shift happening. At the same time, with any paradigm shift, we're also seeing pushback. You know, there's also people fighting us. There's also people trying to undermine us and degrade us and try and destroy our credibility. But we see that as a reverse compliment now, because we've gone from being sort of dismissed to being seen as a serious threat. But in the end, it's like the food companies. We're not a serious threat. join us, because this is a win-win for them as well, and they will improve their bottom line by joining us.
Well, that's something that I wondered about, because I've begun to suspect, and maybe this isn't true from what you're saying, but I've begun to suspect that if you were to have a genuinely sustainable, healthy, regenerative food system that didn't make you sick and so on, that a lot of farmers would make a living, but nobody would get rich.
Look, I suppose that's a funny one. The answer is yes. You know, it depends on the individual. Some will get rich. You know, some people want to be rich. Other people are just very happy making a good living and having a good standard of living. You know, it just depends on the individual. And I think here this is the thing where it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not a silver bullet. It's multiple solutions. So, you know, we've talked about the big food companies coming on board, but we also need to build local systems. This is really important, and revitalize local communities. They forget that people come in communities. The first community is our family, and then our local community. It's really important. We need to also build consumers and farmers as a community, because there's a disconnect at the moment, and, you know, bring them together. So these are things that we're doing. Local markets are really important. What we call participatory guarantee systems. Even on longer chain systems now, where, because we'll always have them. There'll always be exports. It's just the nature of the world. While we need to grow the local systems, we have to accept also we have exports. But now we can use QR codes and someone can get their phone and see the farm and the farmer where it's growing. So we can actually bring the farmer and consumer together in many different ways. And I think this is really important, to build this new community of progressive consumers and progressive farmers.
What about, I mean, big agriculture, they're, as you said, they lost a lot of money last year. What was it, $4 billion? And they rely on so-called conventional agriculture, where the soil is devoid of this biological life, where they rely on ever higher uses of pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers. And, I mean, it seems like there has to be an outside limit to where the whole thing breaks down. But first of all, is there that limit?
We passed that limit. We probably passed it in the 1980s when we got what was called yield decline. Didn't matter how much pesticide, how much fertilizer was put in, our yields were going down because they basically burnt up all the organic matter where most of the nutrients are and started destroying the soils as well. And so yields have been steadily decreasing. So then the next silver bullet has been GMOs, and they were first introduced, you know, 20 years ago, you know, about 1995, 1996. Now they are failing. So we're talking about other silver bullets. There are no silver bullets. There never have been silver bullets. History will show you that. And we've got to get back to basically what we're going to call is natural systems, start using the ecological science, look at diversity in our systems, diversity in our production, diversity in our markets. We need to look at, you know, systems that are appropriate for local areas, and that includes the local climate, the local soils, but marketing systems that are also appropriate for that local area, and work local first and then spread out. There'll always be a role for big ag. They're not going to disappear. But we need to actually, how can you say, take away their dominance and start empowering farmers and communities to take control of their own life, develop their own systems, make their own decisions, and not have it made for them.
I understand that we, for example, in Santa Fe, we have a wonderful farmers market, and there are ever more farmers markets all over the country, all over the world. At the same time, you've got the Central Valley of California that provides most of the vegetables that and nuts and all kinds of things that Americans eat. You've got these cornfields in Iowa that it takes 3 days to walk across one of them. And so, How do you envision a transition? Like, what happens to Iowa?
Okay. Well, let's look at Iowa, for instance, a very good example. Where does most of that corn go? Well, not to direct human food. It either goes to the confined animal feeding operations, CAFOs, or to ethanol. Very little of that is for direct human consumption. You know, so what would happen to Iowa? Well, we'd actually, instead of having these vast monocultures of corn after corn or corn and GMO soybeans, we can start going into these very diverse systems and produce a lot more food. California, well, you know, let's look at what life has been like in California for the last few years and the issue of water. And California is in serious trouble. Whether that is long-term or not is going to be very interesting to see. But I think you'll find that those growers will not go out of business because we start up local systems and local vegetables, because we have a growing population in the world. We're going to need that food anyway. But also, as they change to more sustainable systems, they will become more profitable. At the moment, I suppose, when I look at California, it just seems that almond growing is the main gold rush at the moment. But at some point, what will happen there, as it happens everywhere else, because it's not just California now doing almonds, it's all Mediterranean climates. In my country, in Europe, everybody's saying, oh, almonds, will do what is always done, oversupply the market, and what is a gold mine will collapse, and the price of almonds will become uneconomical, and people will start pulling them out like they're pulling out grapes at the moment to plant almonds. So you see these trends all the time, and this is why I want to get back to diverse polycultures, because you learn that markets come and go. They go up and down. If you have multiple crops and multiple markets, you hedge your bets. It doesn't matter if one market disappears, you can shift it all to another market and still survive. And you know, if one crop fails and you've got five crops, well, it's not your whole crop failing. It's only 20%. It's not going to destroy your business. And this is why we need to go over to diverse systems, so we actually are resilient, not just in what we produce, but what we sell.
You wrote a book called The Myths of Safe Pesticides, and the myths that you talk about are the myth that pesticides are rigorously tested, that you only need very small amounts, that they break down, that they are very well and safely regulated, and that they're essential. And you debunk every single one of these myths. Let's talk about for a moment the downside of pesticides. What happens when we eat food that has been sprayed with pesticides, even if we wash that food?
Yeah, look, I know people say wash food before you eat it to get rid of the pesticides. That's actually a load of rubbish. Most of the pesticides are sprayed with stickers, so if it rains, the pesticides don't wash off. So those type of pesticides won't get off. But many of the pesticides are what we call systemic. They get absorbed by the whole plant. So they're not just on the surface. They're actually inside the plant. And I'll give you an example of, say, some of the pesticides used for fruit fly. They can't kill the eggs. So they've got to wait for up to 2 weeks for the eggs to hatch. And then it needs to be enough poison inside the fruit to kill the caterpillars, the little maggots. So those fruits are still toxic weeks later. And not only that, you know, one of the things I talk about is that when many of these pesticides break down, their breakdown products are even more toxic, and in many cases 100 times more toxic. So 2 weeks later, that bit of fruit is now far more toxic than when it left the farm. So, you know, the authorities say, oh, look, you know, once again, it's just small amounts. But the science shows that, particularly now with endocrine disruption, that the smallest amounts can actually sometimes be more toxic than larger amounts, because in small, when they're at very small levels, they work like hormones and they bind with our hormone systems. So they disrupt, you know, for instance, many of them act like estrogen. And we know that, that they cause a whole range of problems with diseases of the sexual tissues. Now, cancers of the sexual tissues are a major one. Breast cancer in women, ovarian cancer, and in men, prostate cancer. And we know that these endocrine-disrupting chemicals have a major role in it. For instance, Roundup, which is glyphosate. Scientific studies show that it can cause a 5 to 13% increase in the multiplication of estrogen-sensitive breast cancer cells. 80% of breast cancers are estrogen-sensitive. And what we're seeing, too, if you look at the latest figures, is that breast cancer, the amount of women getting breast cancer, still increases. Yes, thanks to science, we have better survival rates, which is good. But the fact that that so many women have to go through the horror of breast cancer, the horror of actually the surgery and basically their own body image being severely changed, you know, it's a terrible thing to put people through. And we can prevent it by taking these toxins out of our food system.
There are many other illnesses and health problems that have been linked to pesticides, and I'm wondering if you could talk about what those health problems are and how strong that link really is. I mean, do we know that they're caused by pesticides?
The answer is yes, we do know now. We have substantial peer-reviewed studies. In some cases, these are what we call epidemiological studies, where we can look at groups of people and their exposure. But these are called correlation studies, and correlation doesn't always mean causation. It could be a coincidence. Some cases where we do standard mathematical formulas for checking these correlations, one is called a Pearson's correlation coefficient, we can find that the probability that this correlation is an accident, in other words, that the chemical, like glyphosate, isn't the cause, can be 1 in 10,000, so we know there's a very high probability. But very importantly, we now have studies that actually look at the biochemical pathways of how these pesticides cause these multiple diseases. So we're looking at now that many of the cancers are caused by pesticide exposure. We're looking at things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in children, autism, many of the behavioral problems in children. It's come out now, you know, with different expert groups now, particularly the World Health Organization and the United Nations Environmental Program did a meta-study on endocrine disruption, and we're looking at the global obesity epidemic. And while in part we can say it's due to junk food, you know, people have been eating this amount of junk food for quite a while. Why are we suddenly seeing this explosion in obesity and type 2 diabetes? And what they're finding now is that it's because of these endocrine-disrupting chemicals. What they have done is when the child has been exposed to small amounts of these chemicals, and it's parts per trillion in the uterus when they are a fetus, it actually changes their metabolism. And as a result, they do not metabolize carbohydrates in the same way. Instead of turning into glucose that most of us will do and use for energy, we're finding that many of them turn it straight into fat. And it's why there's so limited success with these diets. You know, most of these people have tried so hard, and in the end they just give up because nothing is working, and that's because of the changes to their metabolism, and that leads to type 2 diabetes. So we're seeing, you know, if we look at this epidemic of what we call diseases of the modern age, and we can find in the literature how pesticides are a contributor. I'm not going to say the only contributor, but a significant contributor to all of these diseases, every one of them.
Andre Loy, you are the president of IFOAM Organics International, and IFOAM stands for International Federation of Organic Agriculture Movements. What are you doing to move this whole movement forward and to promote a world in which a whole lot more than 1% of agriculture is this healthy, regenerative, organic agriculture?
We're very busy on this front. In fact, it's our whole purpose of existing. That's our mission statement, is to see this uptake of agricultural systems that are based on our four principles of organic agriculture, which are health, ecology, fairness, and care. So we work on multiple levels. For instance, we're very active in the UN systems and with governments to get policy changed. We are very active on the ground because we believe that this also has to be a bottom-up approach. So you'll see, you know, the reason I'm in an event like this, which is a farmers event, it's very important to us that we work with our key stakeholders, but also with consumers. We have members like the Organic Consumers Association that are talking with progressive consumers. So, and the other thing is with science, and this is one of the ones which is very important to us. We've been ignored by science for a very long time. So we've actually set up a scientific group under IFOAM, where we've got more than 100 universities and research institutions now linked them up on every continent, so we can actually get scientists out of their silos and they can work together and set priorities, get funding, so we can advance organic agriculture on that level.
It's tricky because so much of the funding for agriculture comes from the people who make the chemicals that you're trying to get people not to use.
Look, it is a big issue. You know, once upon a time, funding for agricultural courses came out of governments, and what we've seen over the years is that governments have pulled away and the private sector is putting the money in, and we find this a conflict of interest because basically researchers have to take their agenda, and we believe that, you know, true science, and particularly science in universities, should be independent and shouldn't be subject to this financial pressure. And so we are not happy about that. But what we're trying to do now is, by bringing these groups together, is to look at where we can get the funding. There are other sources out there, so we can fund science and hopefully share that funding around, get researchers on different continents to work together, so we don't reinvent the wheel all the time, and we can get multiple outcomes from that same bit of research.
What is your hope for this movement, say, 20 years from now?
For me, what I'd like to see is that essentially what we're talking about now becomes a given. And we're starting to see that now. You know, for me, being the International Year of the Soil is very important because this is a concept that our movement started almost 100 years ago. And the concept of healthy soils, we're writing about it in the 1920s. We were ridiculed for it, particularly on this issue of soil organic matter. In the 1970s when I started, and if you did agronomy, you were told that the only reason we needed the soil was so the plants didn't fall over and we could essentially do it hydroponically, give them all the chemicals and grow these good crops. That has failed. It's a nonsense. And now we've gone the full circle, and this year the theme is healthy soil, healthy people, which is our theme. Sir Albert Howard, who I talked about before, said the health of the soil, the plants and animals, and the people that depend on them, is one and indivisible. In other words, it's been our basic concept that we start with healthy soils, that way we get healthy crops. Our stock is healthy, and us as humans who feed off that are healthy. And it's really nice to see that the United Nations now has taken that. So we're seeing this paradigm shift.
André Loy is author of the book, The Myths of Safe Pesticides. He's the president of IFOAM Organics International. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.